Erling Jorsten from St. Olaf, and my field of interest for research and for writing is the relationship between religion and politics, and I've got a couple of things that I've enjoyed doing over the years, and as I've suggested, it's controversial. Will Rogers once said, to come back to that point of departure, that the surest way to get in an argument with your fellow American is to give her or him your recipe for how religion and politics mix in this country, and you'll have an instant argument, you know, on your hand. And I'm familiar with this, and I welcome this, and I hope we have some arguments because I think that's fun, and I think maybe Terry, you would agree, the worst insult I think to a speaker is to be ignored. the worst thing is to be boring, and to have people say it was pretty good. I'd much rather say it was bad, but to say it's dull or boring, I think is wide of the point. But anyway, I'm here to do a series this week on notable Americans. Some, like Jackson, are a perfect combination of religion and politics. So how, you know, just to stop, the, you know, some of this will have to be sort of instant analysis because I'm, you know, I've still got some things I haven't even digested into my notes yet on Jackson. But how many times has there been a man who has worn the garb of a cleric giving a political speech, you know, in a pulpit, and getting 500 delegate votes at a convention? This is just an astounding thing. It'll take a long time for this to, you know, to be absorbed and understood in what's happening here. So Jackson's a good combination. Reagan, I'm going to talk about tomorrow, not in any kind of partisan sense. We're not going to go into the rhetoric. I heard Cuomo and I heard Ferrero and, you know, I heard them all last week. Some of you who were up at the Village last week have no idea, you know, what we're talking about. But it's not going to be what's wrong with foreign policy or deficits or anything. But Reagan, as a representative of another strain of a combination of religion and politics in America. And then Wednesday is Christmas, and Thursday will be on Reverend Moon, and he's back in the news because he went to jail last Friday. And he did go, and he's in a middle security facility in Danbury, Connecticut, and be glad to talk about that, especially since last year, well, in the last, it'll be 11 months now, I've gone to two conferences by Moonies and about Moonies, and I'd be glad to talk about that and talk some things about that. And then on Friday and Saturdays, people a little bit more into the religious rather than in the political sphere, but they're well known in this country, Billy Graham and Robert Shuler, because you get a lot of interest there. And I'm happy to do this because I tell people ahead of time, in a way it's selfish because I write for Augsburg Publishing, and my editor there, Rowan Siebold, says, Erling, when you go out to Holden, find out what the people are interested in. What's on their minds? What are their questions? And since I do contemporary history, then maybe we can work with that. And that's what I've tried to do with the books I've had on the moral majority and on, you know, on the charismatics and on evangelicals and the rest. So in a way, it's selfish because I find at Holden, that's the best audience I have by far anywhere. The audiences here are just the very best by way of learning what's going on in people's heads. Because in the colleges, you don't find out. When you do something, you give what you think is a real spellbinder. I see Greg back there, and he's going to disagree with me. But all right, anyway. What you find out is what they want to know what you're looking for in the final examination. So with a group like this, you don't have to pass a test. You don't have to pay tuition. And I hope I've encouraged you to say whatever you want in any given time. If you want to stand right up and give a, you know, little speech at the time, that's fine with me. I was talking to an elder hostel 2 years ago, and I was holding forth against Jerry Falwell. And it was a fellow on the front row. I'd say between 70 and 75, and he stood right up after I'd given about three sentences, and he shook his finger. Don't you lecture me, sonny boy. Well, for one thing, I hadn't been called sonny boy for about 30 years, and I was delighted. And some of the other people were taken aback. Weren't you bothered, or, you know, whatever? And I tried to tell them, you know, that this is where we get a good dialogue to get started with something like this. If people had just walked away and said, this is what George had said about for Jerry Falwell and put it in the files, and then I thought, as far as I'm concerned, the hour would have been wasted. So if you have any comment or discussion anywhere along the line, I'm more than welcome this because I'm happy to do this. Okay. Today, Jesse Jackson, not since he's not running for office, at least for another 2 years, We don't have to worry about anything I say or anything anybody else here being construed as some kind of partisan election operation. But Jackson as certainly a representative of what might become one of, I think, the most important new trends in American politics and in American religious life. And I can't wing it any longer, so I'm going to have to go to my notes here and see what happens. Okay, this subject requires a little introduction. I knew before starting to write this that my comments would be made before the San Francisco Convention, and that that I would be talking about this right after the San Francisco convention, and that maybe everything I said here would have been wiped out by this, because it might have happened before the convention that what Jackson had done at the convention might have simply been totally irrelevant. And I thought about that because I've got my notes here. I wrote this speech not knowing that it might not ever be given. I wrote it on a perfectly wonderful June day in Minnesota. And some of you know I'm a bicycle rider, and I gave up a whole day of bicycle riding to give this speech. And so I figured that's a good works here. I should get a little bit of a reward for that. Okay. Now, so what we'll look at, with lots of time for discussion, is how was Jackson perceived before San Francisco? Something of a balance sheet there. And then in good Holden fashion, we'll, hum a few bars and wing it from that point on and see what happens. I've learned that in the old days of Holden hilarity and spontaneity, that you try something, the days of Carol Hinderly, for instance, and some of the rest. And I don't think Carol ever prepared once, for more than 15 minutes, but they always came out great afterwards. And you remember Carol's inimitable style, and that's the way I learned here, and so I'm too old to change with that. Okay. Now, what is of interest really here by way of introduction is I think that for a long time, I think Americans thought that any sort of revival of interest or direct impact of organized religion on American organized politics was simply passé, that we were too secular a society, we were too worldly, we had simply put this away, and that that issue, thank goodness for a lot of people, was dead and gone. It was left up to historians like myself to talk about that, and now that we had been liberated from all this kind of talk, that we wouldn't have to worry about this any longer, and there was a sort of an attempt to sanitize our language on this, so that any references to this would be done away with completely. But clearly, what has happened, and it pops back and forth once in a while, but clearly, what's happened is that the proper connection and agenda for combining religion and politics in America is very much on the front burner again. That's all I'm trying to say here at the beginning. And it's due, I think, in large part, if not almost entirely, to the fact that Reverend Jackson is the first black and the first clergyman to become a major candidate for the presidential nomination. To be sure, I know in 1972, Representative Shirley Chisholm of New York got 152 votes for the Democratic nomination at the Democratic convention, and that in 1888 the ex-slave Frederick Douglass got one vote at the Republican convention at that time. But I put the emphasis here on the word major because nobody from the black community has had the kind of clout that Jackson has had at that time. Jackson is the first serious clergyman to be a presidential candidate. And the black churches, as such, have become a major source, really, of support for him. That's new. The churches are organizing, and I want to talk about that whole registration thing, and I want to talk about this a little bit later, too, because maybe you saw Ken Woodward's piece in Newsweek about a month ago, this thing called Concerned Americans for Traditional Values. They are out organizing, and they're organizing in a big way, and there's a battle back and forth. But Jackson is an indication that religion is very much back in American political life again. And it's not surprising here, and I don't mean this in a partisan sense, simply in an analytical sense, it's not surprising that he's doing it in the Democratic Party, because if you stop to think, actually in one sense, Jackson is new because he's black and as a major figure, but in another sense, starting with McGovern in 1972, there has been sort of a resurgence of what you might call sort of an evangelical flavor to Democratic candidates again. George McGovern, his father was a Wesley Methodist from South Dakota, and he's a PK. Gary Hart, graduate of Yale Divinity School. Walter Mondale is a PK. His father was a Methodist preacher. We all know about Jimmy Carter. And now we have Jesse Jackson. Five in the last 12 years, three in this particular one, who have come from this sort of thing and haven't tried to hide it, or haven't tried to put it on the back burner, haven't tried to minimize this sort of thing altogether. For instance, so it's back in vogue again. And as I said, I think before, it'd be fun to speculate what would have happened to the candidacies of, say, Hart or Mondale or Reagan if they had come forward in front of the TV cameras donned in clerical garb and given a political campaign speech, you know, in a church. I think it would have been a remarkable kind of event. And furthermore, some of the issues, besides the candidates, some of the specific issues this year are very much focused on this question of the constitutional relationship between organized religion and organized politics. I only have to rattle off three or four here for you. Prayer in schools is one we all lived through in the last 3 or 4 months, and that is not a partisan issue. In Minnesota, where I come from, both United States senators voted against it, Durenberger and Boschwitz. And yet there were more Republicans who voted for it than who voted against it across the country. This is not a partisan issue, but it's very much a lively issue. Or what we call equal access. This is a very lively issue. Should organized religious groups have access to public school facilities after school the way would, let's say, a stamp club would, or a chess club, or something else would do that? Some people say, yes, if the chess club can use, 101, why can't, Young Life, or InterVarsity, or, one of these groups like that? And other people will say, some of my separationist friends will say, no, that's just the opening wedge, and once you let that happen, pretty soon they'll be wanting time during school and all the rest. Or the moment of silence. Now, that was, a compromise when it was clear that the school prayer amendment and the Bible reading wasn't going to go through. They said, well, every school should be allowed to have the right to have a moment of silence ahead of time. And that doesn't mean that that's necessarily a prayer. And the separationist friends will say, no, that is just the opening time, or the opening wedge, I should say, for when pretty soon we're going to have organized prayer back in, such as led to all the controversy you remember in the 1960s with this sort of thing. Or another one that doesn't deal with the schools, but which is very much alive, well, it's two parts really of the same problem, manger scenes in public squares. Pawtucket, Rhode Island, I give you as Exhibit A on that one, where the Supreme Court split 5-4. And it isn't clear really that the reasoning that, Berger used on that was altogether clear. And I want to talk about that maybe a little bit later. Or some, I don't know if any of you are from Rochester, Minnesota, or from Sioux Falls, were having Christmas carols at the public schools right before Christmas. Are these traditional things like chestnuts on a roasting fire, or Rudolph? Can you sing those, but you can't sing some of the great old classics? And then, the battles that go back and forth. My students from Rochester, anybody here from Rochester? My students tell me that the families and friends still aren't talking to each other because of the battles that went on down in Rochester and the public school system over that. So you see, there are lots of issues back and forth that are going on, and Jackson doesn't have answers to all of these, and I don't think that, say, Jackson had been elected, that would have solved the problems, but his presence and the kind of campaign that he ran really, I think, raises all kinds of new issues altogether. Okay, so what I'm going to suggest, yeah, there we see it.
Just an interjection. You're talking about these types of things. I don't know if you're aware of what happened down in Houston, Texas. What?
Houston, nothing would surprise me, but go ahead.
Where a county commissioner had religious symbols erected in a city park.
Yeah.
And they had Christian and Jewish and all the rest. And of course, there was another group that has rejected it and has gone to the courts and so forth. Whether he should be allowed to use private money or city money to erect these symbols. I don't know if you've heard of that.
There was one. We always have somebody here from Oregon. Whatever happened, was it around Portland? The Christ on the up around the hills?
Eugene.
Well, Eugene, yeah.
The cross,
was it the cross? What happened?
A war memorial, but
that got
holidays, it is left otherwise.
Okay.
Christmas, Easter, and Veterans Day or something like that.
And Veterans Day, that's a great Christian holiday, yeah.
Well, one thing, I go to Mesa Arizona the winters, and down there, Mesa's a Mormon town, and you never hear one word about it. That you shouldn't have religious songs in schools. Every school puts on a big program and everybody in the community is invited.
Yeah.
They just don't
And then what happens, you go, I guess Idaho is even more Mormon than in terms of numbers than Utah.
It happens to be a Mormon town.
And what happens to the kid who is, who isn't Mormon? so you know, you get the thing right back again. Okay, so all right, you get the idea. Anyway, with that introduction, such as it is, my thesis will be that I think that I want to propose this: that the Jackson campaign this year will really, first of all, will really remake much of the way in which we perceive what electoral politics can do. I think that's the basic question. What do we really expect that our political leaders can do? And another question, on the other side is, what should they do? I think we would, if I took a poll here, we would have instant disagreement on both of these things, and we'd have as many opinions, like Will Rogers said, as we would have people here. But I think the Jackson campaign will remake much of the way in which we perceive what electoral politics can do, and secondly, I think it'll be proof, and of course, I have to say here, I'm indulging in a real luxury, because I'm a historian and I'm talking about the future. And that's one reason I love to come to Holden. I don't have to be a traditional historian and wait 50 years like the British do before you can talk about anything. The British wait because they say there's too much, there's too much controversy and we don't know enough. But I'm, I let the cork get out of my libido bottle here and do what I want to do, talk about the future. But anyway, I think the Jackson campaign, I think, will help convince us that the old way of electing presidents is over. I really think that it's going to go a long way in doing that. And thirdly, and here's where we get into some real controversy, it will help bring into the open how divided over race and class and ideology Americans really are. I think that's a very important point, how divided we still really are and what that means. Should we try to cover it up and keep putting Band-Aids over it, or should we, let it all hang out, as we like to say in the 1960s? And sometimes, maybe some of you have gone to controversies, maybe in your congregations where you've had board controversies, where you decided to really let it all out, and what happens is that you go away more angry at each other than when you had started. My brother, I could always tell when my brother had not every time, but many times when he would have a board controversy. He's a pastor in Tucson. And the thing that upset him most was the controversies with the board. And he said sometimes he decided just not to put some things on the agenda because there was more grief after having let it all hang out than before. But that's a real issue. How divided over race, class, ideology Americans really are. And I certainly would welcome all your comments on that. And going back to Jesse Jackson here, I think it will help create new ways of enlisting Americans to get involved. I think that's a very important thing, getting new people or more people involved. What was it in 1980? 53.2% of the total number of people eligible voted. I think, 53.2. And if you look and say in Western Europe, every country is over 90%. I mean, every country is over 90%. And it's fascinating to think of in Western Europe also, they vote on Sundays. That's something to think about instead of the first Tuesday after the first Monday. And maybe that's, in November, as we have in this country. I think that must be in the Old Testament somewhere, Terry, that we have to vote somewhere that way. Okay. That's true, that we're going to have to look at new ways of getting more people involved. But in another way, Jackson's campaign, I think, has already established or underlined or re-underlined an older, more traditional note. There's something traditional here, too, in presidential election politics. Jackson has understood, I think, that modern political communication, dominated by television images, by polling, by media consultants, has lost the power to speak plainly and arouse deep emotions in voters. I think that's what I want to repeat that because I think that's so important. That he has understood that modern political communication, sometimes you hear people, they have their job descriptions, in some of these political parties and these organized groups, and you wonder what in the world all that means. And I think they wonder sometimes what they're supposed to be doing too. Mm-hmm. Classic example, and I'll be using it later on too, Mondale was in New Hampshire with the best organization ever in American electoral politics for 2 years, repeat 2 years, and he lost. With all the campaigning and the slick, media consultants and all the rest, he lost. And another, you get the idea, okay. But Jackson has just realized or brought back the realization that politicians know that can speak plain, those who do speak plainly can arouse deeper emotions in voters. Jackson really is a throwback to that era when politics and political rallies were a political form of both entertainment and enlightenment in America. Where, for instance, I always remember one wonderful line LBJ used once. He said, "You all come down and listen to the speaking." Like the speaking was just one more part. It was a 4th of July rally or something like that, like the eating or like the softball game or the tug of war or whatever else. But everybody accepted the fact that speaking was a part of the ritual that everybody attended or followed at this time. And I think Jackson has done that. One wrote a report this, following him from church to church, one is struck by the joy and good feeling he produces. People came expecting to be aroused and entertained, and Jesse did not disappoint them. There is a lesson in this for other politicians. Okay. So, with knowing now what's happened in, well, let me use one here, especially for some of my friends, the elder hospital people. Now I would say, and now for page two. Does that help make the transition here? I don't agree with Paul Harvey, but once in a while he has a couple good journalistic lines. Okay, now for page two. Here I think is what many observers and critics and friends alike have perceived as to what was happening with the Jackson campaign. First of all, last spring he caught our attention by a series of spectacular public relations moves. It at first seemed like here was a lark, a curiosity piece. The trip to Lebanon, bringing back the pilot, the Navy pilot. But it, within a couple of months, I think it became clear that he had won large, enthusiastic audiences. He had substantial funding. He had been able to convince a significant number of people that he was not a flash in the pan. And he had done so by taking some very controversial kinds of stands. Being coming out in favor of the PLO is not guaranteed to, win you a good number, how well organized the PLO lobby is in America. It just doesn't have a lot of, clout behind it. But Jackson did that, among others. I've got, this is where I'm not all that organized because this is also new with this. And he didn't repudiate Louis Farrakhan for a long time, and that's something we could talk about on more or less maybe the negative side on this. But it was clear he won a large enthusiastic audience. It's not a flash in the pan. In other words, he opened up the reality that in spite of all the work that Mondale had been doing for a long time, and I come from, well, I knew him back in college, in fact, so I can say everybody likes to drop names, and I knew Fritz back when he was a student, and I like to tell people, a couple of you know this, I actually did have a date with who was then Joan Adams, and she is now Joan Mondale, and I thought there was going to be a second date, and there wasn't, and I finally decided, well, that's her loss, that's not mine. She was an art history major at McAllister. Her father, she's a PK too, there's another one. Her father was Presbyterian chaplain at McAllister. And some of you know the SPAN program at the University of Minnesota in the summers, and we were in England. All right, anyway. But Jackson showed that with the kind of campaign that he had, he could break through the alleged hammerlock that Mondale had. And that brings up a second point about Jackson, I think, that's very important in this particular connection about why he had the attraction that he did. By San Francisco, of the eight, you remember, who started, only three were left. And look at who he had defeated. He had outdistanced three United States senators, and two, including two very well-known ones, in the person of McGovern and Glenn. And the other one, of course, Alan Cranston, plus Ruben Askew, and of course Hollings, and in fact we have to put in a kind word for Senator Hollings. He's the one Lutheran in the United States Senate. He's in that old South Carolina LCA tradition, isn't he, of Lutheranism that we have down in the South down there. All right, and it's also necessary. Well, I'll save that for tomorrow. I won't say today that Edwin Meese is a Lutheran, but I'll bring that in tomorrow when we talk about Reagan. Okay, so. What I'm suggesting here is that Jackson looked at the party establishment. He looked at, seven very powerful, well-established, well-known names. Maybe Ruben Askew isn't a household word. But I think my own feeling is with Askew, he was redecorating his den and he wanted a lot of new memorabilia to put around, all the things that you could put on your walls and on your desk about voting for Ruben Askew. And so on. Apparently, seriously though, he ran on a pro-life thing. That's the only chance he thought he had was to win on strictly pro-life, and it didn't work. All right. What I'm trying to suggest here with Jackson, though, is that perhaps party affiliation might really be finished as necessity for electing a president in this country. Maybe that's a possibility. Okay. A third thing about Jackson's background here and his rise to prominence, would anybody last November have believed that a black 42-year-old with only minimal national recognition, not many people knew about Operation Push in Chicago, for instance, would anybody believe that a black 42-year-old, minimal national recognition, would have come this far? He had no media consultants, he had very little money, and he himself has never held elective office. Every one of the other seven who ran, obviously, were well steeped in the political process, all of them. Mondale was going way back, I think, back in high school. He was already president of the student body or something, and a political animal, and just like Hart and all the rest. Glenn, once he got into it. That gives one pause, I think, to think about this, pause to think if we are perhaps going back to the old Andrew Jackson idea that any person of goodwill and of intelligence and energy should be able to hold political office. Jackson, I think, broke through that or created re-interest in that that other kind of Jacksonian idea. Fourth, his personality, and we can talk a lot about that because I think it's important. He was not the product, you see, of some mass media cookie-cutter TV office at all. He was very much himself from the very beginning. In fact, sometimes that got him into trouble. I think my own feeling is, this is just a reaction on my part, my own feeling is that he got into trouble with Louis Farrakhan about the Farrakhan thing because the media wanted him to do something, and they pushed him very hard right from the very beginning. And he wasn't ready for how strong and how pervasive national media attention can be. And he just didn't want to do what the national media told him to do. And so he sort of got his, whatever you want to call it, dukes up or something else, and simply, I think, tried to declare that just because McNeil and Lehrer and some other people wanted this, that necessarily, decided the case or the course of action for him. I think that's possible. It was the white media who demanded it, and Jackson refused to go along with this sort of thing. Okay. I think the personality is very important. Finally, I think, was his quickness to use opportunities, creatively and almost instinctively. He has a great sense of timing. To take a new opportunity and to see political possibilities in this. Instead of, for instance, with Mondale, Mondale won in the course in politics. There are all kinds of losers and one winner, and I'll concede that. But Mondale's, and for that matter, Hart's two campaigns were programmed. They were locked in. And they followed, the script pretty much right down the line. And that meant some victory some places and some losses somewhere else. But Jackson was able to take some opportunities, and to wing them. The trip to Syria, for instance, would be a good example of this. He even tried, you remember, right after the Olympic flap, to go to Moscow. He certainly was thinking big. I mean, he wasn't just going to talk to some underling somewhere, some bureaucrat, but he wanted to go right to the Kremlin. And he thought, well, the Kremlin should be glad to see him. And some people might think that's foolish, but I think that's confident thinking as to what could happen. And the whole thing was Cuba. I give you, 49 people altogether by the time there were 22 Americans and then 27 political prisoners. I think it was 49. The press was kind of vague between 48 and 49, but it was a new in American history for this sort of thing. And people said, well, you played into Castro's hands. Castro looks a little better because of what you did there. And I like Jackson's reply. He was answering, oh yeah, George Will. And if you know how tough George Will can be is on Meet the Press or whichever one it is. And Will was really going after him. And Jackson came back without being smug, I think, about it. And he said, I know that there are 22 more Americans back with their families in America now than there were before I left. And that's all he had to say. Just wiped out all this business about helping Castro altogether. And I thought it was, again, a good example of being very quick on a response for this sort of thing. I think I've already covered that next point. Okay, now, I think those are pretty much the pluses. But I think it also has to be said that there are some negatives that have to be talked about here also, because nobody gets into American politics, and I can't say coming on the white horse, can I, in his particular case. We're talking about metaphors because that would not have worked too well. There are some negatives. You have to make accommodations, and some people don't understand that in American politics, especially to get back to the point I made at the beginning, especially when you try to look at it from what I would call something of an organized religious viewpoint. Because some of the people, for instance, I have studied think that in politics you go in there like you would in a doctrinal fight in which you're going to hammer out some new doctrine, let's say on Trinity or virgin birth or something else like that, and it's a matter of getting your way and converting everybody over to your side because you have got the truth. What is it Robert McAfee Brown says? Wonderful quotation, and he said, he's oftentimes very controversial, and he's one of my particular favorites in the field of ethics, and he said he would rather face Genghis Khan with all his thousands of hordes than one 16th century Calvinist armed with the truth. And I think that's right. Okay, anyway. In politics, the point is that sometimes accommodations have to be made. Politics is not a matter of winning or hammering out doctrinal purity. The way some, for instance, I teach American religious history, and some of my friends back in 16th century thought that they couldn't wait to get into some really good, exciting doctrinal fight. They were really going to hammer this out once and for all, and then we were going to settle the issue once and for all. Politics is obviously nothing at all like that, but you get some people, especially from an organized religious community viewpoint, into politics, and I think that's what politics is all about. Sometime, if we have the chance, I could talk about what's happening in the Minnesota politics, especially in what we call the Independent Republican Party. We're getting a lot of fundamentalists into the Republican Party, and I learned, for instance, that politics does belong to everybody. At first, there were some controversies. Some people were saying, well, these people haven't been in for 20 years. They haven't stuffed envelopes and rung doorbells and done all the rest of these things, and shouldn't politics, the management of politics, really belong to the professionals, and so on. And you know, you can only say about that, politics belongs to everybody. I mean, it's everybody has the right to participate in it, and you shouldn't criticize, let's say, the born-again or fundamentalists for being in politics simply because it's new, or simply because they haven't been there before. That's the only point I want to make with this. But they have come into there, into politics, thinking it's something like a convention or a conference on pure doctrine. And we're even talking about getting fluoride out of water in Minnesota again because of, you know, you think that at least that one had been put away for a long time. They haven't come back with going back to the gold standard yet, but, you know, it's all things are possible. Okay. The negative step, so politics is not a matter of, you know, purity with this. And Jackson has had to learn that. And sometimes Jackson, I think it's been a plus that he hasn't had a lot of high-powered media consultants, but sometimes also it's meant that he hasn't been quite adroit enough or quick enough to make the kind of responses that could have saved him some difficulty. By contrast, let's say to Mondale, I think you're paying, you know, you pay a price here. Mondale's success was that until this last flap right before the convention about, you know, the national director with Manet versus Burt Lance, Mondale's whole strategy had been premised on not making any serious mistakes. He didn't really come out for a whole lot, but on the other hand, he really didn't make any mistakes. And in politics, the press is there, they've got all these booby traps waiting for you along the trail. Remember, in 68, when Edmund Muskie had the audacity to cry in public, that wiped him out, simply because, and then it turned out that had been one of Nixon's dirty plumber's tricks. They had written this letter that was a total lie, and Muskie, when he made his speech in public, remember snowing in New Hampshire and everything, didn't know it was a lie and was so outraged that that it was a trick, one of the plumber's tricks, and that wiped him out. Or I don't think there's any question but that Gerald Ford was defeated in 1976 because of the pardon of Nixon. I think that's about as clear as there is in politics. People just held that against him. So the press is waiting for candidates to make mistakes. That's all I'm trying to say. And Mondale was, you know, very much aware of that and simply didn't make mistakes. The one mistake he made was appointing Burt Lance instead of firing Manet. Then, of course, it backfired on him, and he was saved by the brilliant, keynote speech by Mario Cuomo. It was such a good speech that people just forgot about all the trouble Mondale was in, so his momentum kept going again. Okay, Jackson, on the other hand, spontaneous, free spirit, his own person all the way, simply avoided, I think, and that, but it got him into some troubles. Remember, way back at the beginning, there was some controversy, and it hasn't really been cleared up yet, about what we like to call euphemistically financial irregularities. There were some questions about this. Where was he getting his money? Where was the money coming from on that? There was, and especially not only for the campaign, but there was some question, where was he getting his money for his black self-help program in South Chicago called Operation Push? And as it came out, and it didn't come out, as smoothly as it could have, that some of the money was coming from some Arab lobbies in Washington and New York. And of course that raises the larger question of anti-Semitism that got connected in with the Farrakhan thing a little bit later. But Jackson did not really understand, or maybe didn't want to, because he didn't want the white press telling him what he should or shouldn't do. He didn't come straight forward with, notarized accounts of the allegations against his finances and his financial sources from Operation Push. with this sort of thing. And that was one thing. Secondly, especially in the early stages of the debates, it became fairly clear that he was not really well informed on some of the major issues. Sometimes, you know, he was always aware of being called a motor mouth. Or another term that was used was a loose cannon. And I think that's a fairly good one. And some people thought that he had other motives than, you know, what he really had in mind, you know, because he hadn't done the work. He hadn't done a lot of work, for instance, on the downing of the Korean airline. He'd said some things there that, you know, had to be retracted later. And he didn't have a lot of specifics on where the revenue would come for all the finances that he wanted for welfare and construction programs. And sometimes on some of the national pressings like Meet the Press and Face the Nation, some of his you know, comments were very much open to question, especially the rest. But then what came on later when he became clear he was a serious candidate, he found out that he had done his work and had done his homework very well. I think I've got one quotation here. Yeah, Jackson never, this is a sort of a summary, Over the Rainbow, a Jackson scrapbook by one reporter who followed him all the way through. Jackson never figured he'd get all the votes, but he felt he was smart and had something to say, and people would listen. He wanted white Americans to know that a black man could play pure politics on his own terms. A few minutes after the first candidate debate ended on Dartmouth College, January 15th, Jackson blurted out, "They expected a motor mouth, but I held my own with the big boys." The campaign had come a long ways in a rather short period of time. I think those are some... Those are some kind of negatives that have to be talked about. I'd be glad to talk about the Louis Farrakhan thing in some detail, but I don't know how much detail we want to go in on that. But I think those things have to be said. Okay. And summing up at this particular point, though, I think I would agree, granted these sort of negative things, I would agree with the writer Ronald Smothers of the New York Times. He said that Jackson was making history as as I said before, a serious black presidential candidate. That is... That development alone is likely to have far-reaching effects on the American political scene because of energizing the black vote and by altering the perceptions among whites of black candidates for elective office. I think those are two things worth mentioning. He's energizing the black vote. If you remember, if you watched the campaign last week, energizing was the key verb I think they were using all the way through, and the media was always talking, will this speech energize the voters? Or will that one, or Ferraro, or whatever it is, energize the voters? And so, if there's a key word so far, at least from the capital E Democratic perspective, I think it's that matter of energizing. But I think he has done this, and it's the energizing the black vote, and he's also altered the perceptions among many whites of black candidates for elective office. Already, what's happened is that there is a Republican response to this. And this showed up, for instance, for those who were watching carefully, in what President Reagan was doing around the July 4th time. Reagan, everything is political. I'm not saying this is right or wrong or anything else, but everything in an election year is political. And you'll remember that President Reagan went to the Daytona 400, the automobile race, the firecracker, whatever it's called. It's a 400-mile one, isn't it, right? And knowing ahead of time, well, two reasons he went there. One, these kinds of races attract blue-collar workers, and Reagan has some trouble with the organized blue-collar community, for one thing. And secondly, it was clear ahead of time, and his political operatives knew that there wouldn't be very many blacks there. It's primarily white. Have you ever seen, Tom Sneva or A.J. Foyt or Hoyt or any of these people? Obviously, there is a cultural kind of distinction there. And then he went on to a little town of 7,000 in Alabama, Decatur, Alabama, for his 4th of July speech. Well, there are no blacks living in Decatur, Alabama. And the point is that he was going down and knowing he has to win the South, there are more white voters in the South than there are black. And so therefore the thing to do is to start to energize mobilizing those people who might not register and vote in the South already. See what Jackson's candidacy has done. He's energizing the black vote, and now the counter response is appearing all together. Okay, with this. Okay, his is a calculated gamble for several reasons. As I've suggested before, it'll mean that if let's say that Mondale loses, it'll mean that Mondale's carefully orchestrated plan to put together the old FDR coalition, which is the whole basis, really, you know, organized labor and the rest for Mondale, it'll mean that that will have failed. Because I can't imagine anybody, if assuming Mondale loses, anybody after that time will try to use the old success formula that FDR used in 32 and in 36. He didn't need it by 1940 because of, you know, the war and all the rest. But I think that that will mean then that we'll have to start all over again. That means the Democratic Party would have to start rebuilding from a new base altogether, a bottom line not yet evident. And in that kind of situation, the whole milieu will be, you know, will be fluid. The key word that the media likes to use, it'll be volatile. It could change quickly and drastically in a short period of time. And I think also, as I suggested before, if Mondale loses, it'll mean that the old personalities, charismatic power, those things which the old party loyalists tried to use for their kingmaking will be, I think, passé. And I think the last thing, and then we'll have chance here for discussion, will be what happens during the campaign when the obvious points of what Jackson is talking about, the race differences, the class differences, class antagonisms, are going to be brought out into the open. Because Jackson, if you heard his speech on Wednesday, wasn't it? Yeah. Clearly, what were there, seven different groups he appealed to, and America's not a blanket, America's a quilt. And a quilt is made up of a lot of different things rather than sort of one uniform approach altogether. And I just want to leave with that particular question of what that might mean so far as the nature of American politics is concerned. Will that in turn produce a backlash against this sort of thing? It's just like people were saying about Ferrero, it isn't time yet for a woman. We have to wait some more. Remember, Reagan said, yes, there will be a Republican, there will be a woman president, and she will be a Republican. That was his reply to Jerry Ferraro. Very good political insight from his perspective. I'm trying to look at it from his perspective. But he's saying also that their time hasn't come. And the whole attack against Ferraro is going to be that she's not qualified. She's only had 6 years in Congress, you know, and the whole rest is saying, well, George Bush has had CIA and State Department and all the rest of these things. But anyway, I don't want to start talking about that because it'll get into partisanship. All right. And yeah, here's the thing. Might not the Jackson campaign actually deepen further class and race conflicts in America? And how can that contribute to the public good? So we've got a really exciting kind of situation here. It's a remarkable, new, fresh reorganization of the old battles between religion and politics in this country. And I would just like to throw it open for comments, disagreements. I've got four or five more pages of notes, but we were told yesterday to have more, you know, more discussion. Greg. New stuff. You notice I was telling the people ahead of time, I told my students to come here so you wouldn't hear the same old jokes. Okay. Okay. You see how much respect my students have for me. Yes, please.
Question. Can you confidently say that if Mondale would win, that it would be based on the old formula and not on somewhat of a patchwork coming along and pushing that old formula over?
Well, he's got his basic anchors with organized labor, you know, the special interest charge, and things like the NEA and the Jewish vote and a good deal of rural vote support for himself. And of course the FDR won with the South also, which Mondale right now doesn't have. I don't see, the small number of blacks who did vote in the 30s voted for FDR. Of course they couldn't vote in many of the southern states. So I don't see that there's that Mondale is attracting new kinds of people other than what FDR did.
That's, I guess, what I don't think that he could win based on the old formula, but for picking up the people who were energized by the hard campaign as well, the Jack.
Will he get the yumpies? Young, upwardly mobile professionals. People who live around in Minnesota, Minneapolis, they would live around Lake and Hennepin and go to Calhoun Square shopping center. That's the whole thing is aimed at yumpies. I don't know where it is in Seattle or Houston or anything else, but right. And will he get these? And is there really, you know, firm evidence that Hart really will hold, you know, that the yumpies will sort of sit this one out? Who knows? I know that's one of those, you know, iffy questions, you don't know. But that I think Mondale will have to work very hard at, because you look like a yumpie. Okay. And young, upwardly mobile professional. And what they're doing in the cities is what we call gentrification. They're taking over some of the older areas which have sort of been run down. Summit Avenue in St. Paul has been regentrified. They're not interested in family, so they don't care about public schools. They're just interested in $500 to $600 a month condos with high ceilings and, you know, all the rest of the stuff. And
the outside, all right, just redo the inside.
Right, and will they? It's you know, but I don't see right now that they, you know, but I've heard also that some of the exit polls have been saying that the yumpies are going to vote for Reagan.
Well, I think I live quite near to where Mondale lives. And
North Oaks?
Yes, okay. I live in White Bear Lake.
White Bear, wow.
Same, you know, same area. And North Oaks wasn't too happy with him. They didn't want to move in the first place, and then after he did move in, why, with all of this now, you know, because that's a very select thing.
Yeah.
And I think if he'd have been a Republican, it wouldn't have been quite so bad, because out of all the people I know at North Oaks, I don't know one of them that's a Democrat.
Yeah.
Except Mondale.
Okay. But now, I see your question, and my own feeling is that Mondale's strategy is the last gasp. If it works, fine. But because Carter's, you know, couldn't stand up to the, you know, the re-election pressures of 1980, and it's true that Carter was the only Democrat to have won in the last 12 years, so the Democrats are doing something wrong. And Mondale's is a calculated gamble, having some very shrewd people working for him, that this is where the one place we can go. And I don't think I don't think Mondale was ready for the strength of heart. I think he was really surprised by that. They didn't cope with it, and then he launched an old-fashioned, traditional Harry Truman kind of attack on Hart. Truman used to take it out on the Republicans, not on other Democrats. But Mondale may have had, you know, won the battle, but lost the war on that one. It's an interesting question. Yeah.
Your topic is religion and politics.
Yes.
And what you've been talking about really is Christianity and politics, because the examples you've given have been Christians.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on other religions?
Yeah, I talked about that. I think another thing, I had put that down, that's about page 8 here, and I only got to page 5. Okay, I think that it's clear that the kind of coalition or combination, whatever word you want to use, it, synthesis is a better word here, religion and politics has really, well, until JFK, was very much a white Protestant kind of understanding. The Catholics had tried once with Al Smith in 1928, and of course, Hoover would have won if he had run on the laundry ticket that year, and not anything else, because of the prohibition issue and the prosperity thing. But I think JFK expanded that to some degree in 1960, and it certainly wasn't the Catholic thing wasn't an issue by 1968 with Ed Muskie, and I don't think anybody's going to get too excited over Jerry Ferraro's coming out and saying she's Catholic at all. So I think it did expand there. But on the other hand, it was still white, and I think we're talking about a white sort of Christian, middle or mainline Christian kind of approach that predominated until 1984. And what's going to happen when, maybe if you remember on Wednesday night with, Tuesday night, that was the Jackson time, the Jackson speech, I was delighted when Jackson started giving his sermon, and that's what it was a sermon, and the black audience, the black delegates, were responding just like you were in a black congregation on Sunday morning, with the amens and all the rest. And some people were floored. What in the world is going on here? Why don't these people be quiet? And
did he
knew what he was doing, sure.
Well, no, but I say, did he urge the black people to vote for Mondale and so forth?
He eventually came around, and that bothered a lot of people. I meant, I'm glad you mentioned that, because
I didn't hear it,
yeah,
so
one of the charges against Jackson was that he changed his mind quite a bit on some of the issues. Back and forth, some days before the convention he's saying yes, he'd cooperate with Mondale, other days he would say we've been left out. The women got the women got Ferraro, and the South got Burt Lance, and we didn't get anything. And the best explanation for Jackson's apparent going back and forth on some of the issues, I think, has been made by David Broder of the Washington Post. The starting point is the recognition that Jackson's pre-convention activities, perplexing and vexing as they seem, are not irrational, but stem from his long practice techniques for collecting and using power. For all this talk of the Rainbow Coalition, Jackson has never practiced coalition politics as it is known by elected black officials, from Andrew White in Atlanta to Willie Brown in Sacramento. Okay, he's the Speaker of the House in California. Their instinct is to attach themselves to the largest available group, committed to the largest number of their objectives, and then seek to make them these the realistic agenda of a functioning majority. Coalition politics of that kind carries with it a commitment to negotiation, compromise, if you will, inside dealings. Rather than playing coalition politics, Jackson always played the role of an individual entrepreneur, very much an individual entrepreneur. His talent and his technique is to find or create confrontational situations, like Farrakhan or, you know, some of the PLO or some of the other things that he was talking about, or an absolute cut in defense spending. He wasn't talking about cutting back a little bit each year. He was saying that when I'm in president, we're going to spend less next year. I mean, total number less. That was a break. Hart didn't say that. Mondale didn't say that. Ruben Askew didn't say that. Okay. To create confrontational situations, inject himself in them, and then systematically increase the tension until, at a crucial moment, he agrees to defuse it in return for the concessions materially greater than many suppose, if possible, him for extract for himself and for his cause. This is what I think he's trying to do. In a way, it's like Martin Luther King's technique. Sometimes, if you read his letter from a Birmingham jail, you know this is the way you would escalate the tension. You knew what you were doing. And you had to be prepared for it and trained for it, but it was a calculated risk on their particular point. Here, the difference between coalition politics, that's the Andrew Young kind of politics, and confrontation politics is not a moral difference. One is not good and the other evil. Both are legitimate, but they are very different in practice, as those attempting to deal with Jackson are finding out. They just, you know, that's why they started calling him a motor mouth and loose cannon. They didn't understand what he was doing, but this is what Broder says. The almost daily zigzag in Jackson's rhetoric over the last few weeks, the sudden switches from open threats in provocative language to, he once talked about the Aryan press. That's code black word for white press. Okay, that's a very strong statement when you start talking about the Aryan press. From open threats and provocative language to conciliatory words and gestures, and back again, we're all part of a practice technique of heightening uncertainty, raising tension, putting pressure on the adversary across the table. You never saw, you know, you remember how Hart and Mondale went after each other. I think too much, but that's my own personal feeling. They never criticized Jackson. You get the idea. Okay. The greater the publicity for these seemingly bizarre twists and turns, the more effective they are. I think that helps explain, you know, some of these things. Yeah, on the back.
What do you see in the fact that Andrew Young and Coretta King were so loudly booed they're on the one side and Trevor Jackson on the other.
Well, that was the whole thing. They had, for those who weren't there, the platform fight, the Jackson forces picked out four specific issues on primaries and on defense spending and a couple other things. And they made that, it's in good political style, they made that their focal point. You can't do everything in politics, and so the best thing to do is to concentrate on a few issues and push as hard as you can for a few, rather than spread yourself too thin. And that's what they were trying to do, and they wanted, I think, to make whatever you can call it, a moral stance, a moral gesture on these specific issues. They knew they didn't have the votes. From the very beginning, they knew they didn't have the votes. They knew they didn't have the votes. You notice they were all ready to go to the convention hall even before the balloting was over, because they know they didn't have the votes. But I think they were willing to show the white community that blacks could differ. I think that was one of the points. And furthermore, there is good reason to think that with the organized pros like Andrew Young and like Willie Brown and the others, that and Tom Bradley of Los Angeles, that they are much more willing to cooperate, you know, with the white power brokers than Jackson was willing to do. And Jackson had come this far on this sort of tough, individualistic kind of stance, and he didn't dare let his voters down. If he had concealed, you know, it's a matter of tactics. If he had let his voters down at that, I mean, his supporters down in the platform fight, they probably would have thought that he was simply one more, you know, sellout. The way they perceived, some of them perceived to be, you know, Andrew Young and the others to be. I think that's the way I would interpret that sort of thing.
Is there a third faction there in Mayor Washington of Chicago? Well, that's walking out of the convention.
Yeah. Well, anybody here from Chicago? My son was an intern in a black Chicago parish, Holy Family Lutheran, for a year when Washington came to power, and he tried very hard, and he said that he has no understanding of any of the inner dynamics of urban Chicago politics. He said he had his black friends tell him very openly and everything, and it's very difficult to know. I think if there's any kind of thing that could be said for Chicago politics, it's a matter of patronage. Who is going to give out the jobs? The very old traditional Polish Catholics in Chicago want to hold on to the jobs for themselves. Washington's coming in knowing he's got a strong black power base to work with, and he's not going to let the Dubrinskys and all the rest get by with us any longer. And they are saying, yes, we are going to get by with it longer. And since Washington doesn't have the power of Mayor Daley, that's going to be it. And they want just one wonderful story about Daley. They were, 29 aldermen in Chicago, and they have their weekly conferences. And Daley controlled the PA system. And if he didn't like what somebody was saying, he'd cut them off. And you just can't do that very long. And Washington hasn't tried to do that. One more question before, yeah.
As a historian, you say it's a luxury for you to look into the future. I'm wondering what you think, if Reagan should be reelected and if Jesse doesn't have elected position for at least the next 2 years, what do you see as his future, as his forte? He likes to, personal diplomacy.
He's only 42. And Reagan,
He'll be able to go ahead on these missions to
Moscow? I think he'll keep doing it. They were very, you remember when in Vietnam, Martin Luther King said he was going to go to North Vietnam. And you know what, Nixon opened up every cannon on him for that one. And knew it was good politics to do so. No question about that. And if you want to, I'm trying to think of the name of the act where a private citizen is not supposed to conduct foreign policy. The which? I forget there isn't. I should know it. I'm just blocking here at the moment.
He keeps arguing that he's making these moral appeals.
Yeah.
He doesn't represent the government.
Do you think
the election, Reagan will be as tolerant of those missions?
It depends on the political angle. Reagan is already going to have to start positioning either Howard Baker or Dole or somebody for 1988. And it'll see. I think it'll depend on how energized the black voting bloc has become. If it's dormant, I think they'll simply let it go. But if Jackson's got a good thing, I think they're going. I think they'll try to run somebody against it. Try to do this. Jackson sees himself as a pioneer, the first black to get this far. And he's only 42 and Reagan is 75. And that's a good lead in to who I want to talk about tomorrow. Okay?
Who pays for all of Jackson's trips? All these things?
He's got PAC money and he's got private individuals. Private individuals, yeah. And he himself personally has got a rather substantial income.
One thing that was kind of missed and maybe was out of place with this discussion.